Michael C. Rupert. He is, to put it mildly, a one-off. He's an American author, a former Los Angeles Police Department officer with a bit of a history, an investigative journalist, and a peak oil theorist. Until 2006, he published and edited From the Wilderness, a newsletter and website covering a range of topics, including international politics, the activities of the CIA, peak oil, civil liberties, drugs, economics, and corruption in high places. He's the author of Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil, in which he made the startling claim that American Vice President Dick Cheney was complicit in the 9/11 bombings, a claim that, curiously, has never been contested in a court. Rupert was the subject of the 2009 documentary film Collapse, and his latest book, Confronting Collapse, is a kind of last-ditch plea for economic transformation. Currently, he's the CEO and president of the Collapse Network, a website-based pressure group seeking alternative energy and other lifestyle choices. I saw his doco, Collapse, a couple of weeks ago and gave him a call. You came from a fairly mainstream Republican background, if I could put it that way. What was it that turned you into effectively a caped crusader?
Well, it was more than just mainstream Republican. My mother was a cryptanalyst for the Army Security Agency and NSA, and my father was an Air Force veteran connected to the CIA through Martin Marietta. So that was different, but I became a Los Angeles police officer in 1973. I had interned while I was in college before that, and the agency tried to recruit me, and I discovered that CIA was deeply complicit in bringing drugs into the U.S., and I became a whistleblower.
Really? What tipped you over the edge on that? I mean, most people wouldn't, knowing what the consequences would be. What tipped you over?
Well, it wasn't really tipping me over. It was actually a refusal to bend. When it became clear to me that what I was going to be asked to do would be to protect certain drug shipments and allow them to be delivered, I couldn't do it. That just violated my ethics, and I refused.
What was the objective behind this entry into the drug trade per se? Was it to were there wider objectives at work that the CIA thought this was worth doing compromising for?
The historical model goes back to the British East India Company smuggling opium into China in the 16 and 1700s. In part, it's an economic colonization to raise money. A secondary motive was to fund covert operations that Congress wouldn't approve of.
What happened to you? You've said at various stages you were shot at and you were threatened. What actually happened?
Well, it's a very long story that lasted for a great many years, but I was threatened, harassed, intimidated while I was a police officer as I was trying to find out what was going on. I was shot at once in New Orleans.
Really? By whom?
I didn't ask for ID.
A shadowy figure.
I didn't ask for ID, but
he missed, I assume.
Of course, yes. I had been witness to CIA directly to CIA personnel in being involved in smuggling drugs into the country, and that was something I wasn't supposed to see. So in 1978, there was a deep connection with Iran here, and as the Iranian Revolution really erupted, I started receiving death threats. Again, I was a police officer, and I asked to see the chief of police, and the message that I got back was, the chief is busy, he can give you 5 or 10 minutes in a week to 10 days. If you're still alive, would you like to make an appointment? That's when I resigned.
Yeah. Well, I guess at that stage you realize there's not a great future there.
No.
What did you do then? I mean, you became extremely active in trying to expose what you regarded as illegal and anti-American activities.
Well, for the first decade or so after I left LAPD, I was honing research skills. Of course, I had worked as a detective with LAPD. Doing research through open source media and assembling, if you will, cases, trying to find out what the heck was going on, because I thought surely what I had seen was an aberration rather than systemic, which is exactly what it was. Iran-Contra hadn't even, they were just getting warmed up. But basically, I waged a campaign just to correct what I had seen. But that led me to see deeper and deeper layers of systemic corruption in the U.S. government and especially in the U.S. economy. I evolved from there into being an investigative journalist. The biggest break was in 1996 when Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Gary Webb broke some news stories that absolutely proved that CIA was bringing drugs into the country during the 80s. And I had a confrontation with the CIA director, John Deutsch, at Locke High School, kind of embarrassed him. And that kind of put me on the map. And from that point on, I became a journalist and publisher and author.
Was there any response to the accusations that you made? And you've made a lot over the years, and I'll come to some of them in a minute. But was there any response to this from the, well, I suppose you'd call the establishment? Or did they just ignore it and hope you would go away eventually?
No, they because I'd had this highly public confrontation with the CIA director on ABC and CNN and C-SPAN, and it was all over the world. They had to do something. But there was a 2.5-year investigation, which eventually was just drug out and left to die a cold, miserable death in the bushes. But out of that, a CIA's Inspector General report, Volume 2, did emerge that just absolutely showed that throughout the Iran-Contra year, the CIA was directly involved in both financing, bankrolling, transporting, and huge amounts of cocaine.
Yeah. What, I mean, all this came to a head when you produced your conclusion that 9/11 was a conspiracy. Tell me what brought you to that conclusion.
Well, it took me the better part of 3 years to reach that conclusion. I'm a trained investigator. I'm an investigative journalist. We've broken major exposés. I have a book in the Harvard Business Library. But after 9/11, on the day of 9/11, I knew that there was something seriously wrong because my father had been an Air Force aviator flying interceptors during the Korean War and subsequent. And I knew that standard operating protocols had been totally compromised, violated, when the second airliner hit the World Trade Center. I didn't draw a conclusion from that. I just said something's really wrong. But there was a litany, a very long list of inconsistencies in the U.S. government's position. There were conflicting statements that didn't match reality. And to make a long story short, it was then that I became aware of peak oil, and I showed in my book, Crossing the Rubicon, that Vice President Cheney, who headed an ultra-secret National Energy Policy Development Group, which fought to the Supreme Court twice to keep its records secret, was actually tracking peak oil, and peak oil was the motive for 9/11. And I rested my argument, because there's too much story involved, on the fact that on the day of September 11th, Vice President Cheney had been placed in charge of all war games in May of 2001. Was running 5, 6, 7 different war games that had taken almost all of the fighters out of the Northeast Air Defense Sector, sent them to Alaska, Canada, and Greenland, and that in another war game exercise, I think it was Vigilant Guardian, 22 false radar blips were inserted onto radar screens during the attacks. I have an on-the-record confirmation from First Air Force that in addition to that, there was a live-fly exercise going on during the attacks in which an airliner was posing as a hijacked aircraft. And so there's a lot more evidence in my book, Crossing the Rubicon. But that's the one question that if anybody would ever explain might lead us to deeper conclusions. But now at this point in human history, it's far too late to even try to waste any time on it.
Are you saying that Cheney, the U.S. administration, was let 9/11 happen or actively participated in it?
Actively participated, really? And had command and control of the aircraft. That is, and my book is in the Harvard Business School Library. It's sold 100,000 copies. It's called Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil. It's never been contested. And it's, I think, the second largest selling book about the attacks of 9/11 after the Cain Commission report.
Why did Cheney respond at all? Has he said anything about this? I mean, there's quite a lot of sewable material in it. He hasn't gone after you at all? No lawsuits?
No, he can't even say my name.
I see. It's very hard for people to accept that this scale of willful slaughter of one's countrymen in an interest, in order to preserve an interest which is a long way off, is believable. And you've obviously had a lot of trouble getting people to believe what you've been saying. I mean, yes, 100,000 copies of the book, but has anybody taken it any further? Is it just now too late? And that the conspiracy is the conspiracy theory just remains that.
I walked away completely from the 9/11, the so-called 9/11 truth movement at the end of 2004, 7 years ago, after George Bush stole the second election, as I believe he stole the first, and I just said, the people still want to reopen JFK, but what are the chances of that? I mean, So and we are facing much more serious problems right now, namely the collapse of human industrial civilization, which is underway.
Now, I want to come to that. The columnist David Korn, I think criticized your approach. I think it was a review of something that you'd written. He said this kind of out there conspiracizing serves the interests of the powers that be by making their real transgressions seem tame by comparison. He's got a point, hasn't he?
No. David Korn authored an article for The Nation magazine in which he wrote that I had been fired from the Los Angeles Police Department as a lunatic, when in fact I resigned while earning the highest rating reports possible and being certified for promotion. David Korn has waged a malicious campaign for a long time, and I consider him to be an agent of the United States government. But he's welcome to sue me, too, just like Dick Cheney is.
Yeah. Let me turn the question around somewhat. I mean, do you think that being typecast as a conspiracy theorist essentially undermines your basic thesis about peak oil? I mean, people will say, oh, this guy's a conspiracy theorist. I mean, you know, he's talking now about peak oil, but why should we believe him?
Mainly because over the course of, I started publishing my newsletter From the Wilderness in 1998, and I do not personally keep track of the accuracy of my predictions and analyses, but people who have followed me since then tell me that I'm right in my prediction and analyses roughly 80% of the time. And there is a 3-million-word record that I have left at From the Wilderness in two books, in a documentary called Collapse. And sooner or later, somebody's going to have to read it.
Well, I've read it. There's an implicit consensus about peak oil, which has emerged now. And you're on a winner on this, really. I can see that. I mean, nobody's seriously arguing anymore. Just the OECD, the director of the OECD, the International Energy Agency of the OECD, just said it's over. I mean, we're now having to adapt. But you're saying that because oil is now running out, that we're facing Armageddon, right?
Armageddon is kind of a charged word.
All right.
That I would prefer to avoid. What we are facing now, and
you don't normally avoid charged words, though, do you?
Well, I do when the charge is either unjustified or adds a very strong emotional flavor to the word. And Armageddon carries a lot of spiritual connotation.
Yes. Okay.
Where we are right now is we are in the collapse of human industrial civilization, and it is a very simple, straightforward matter to explain. We live in an infinite growth economic paradigm. When I was interviewed by the Wall Street Journal after the documentary Collapse was released, they said, "What's the point of your movie?" And I said, "Infinite growth is not possible on a finite planet."
But that too, anybody who thinks about it for more than 10 seconds is self-evident. It just remains to become self-evident through market signals, I guess, to the economic community. And isn't peak oil really just a large market signal?
Well, it would be, except for there's an underlying flaw. One of a great many teachers I've had along the way taught me once that a paradigm is something you think about before you think about it. And implicit in what you just said was that money and energy are the same thing, and they are not.
Mm-hmm.
One cannot eat a $20 bill, nor stuff a $20 bill in the gas tank, et cetera, and expect it to do anything. Money is a symbol, represents the ability to do work. Energy is the ability to do work. So what the markets, and the markets are imploding all over the world right now, we're in the midst of we're just beginning an economic implosion many times greater than what happened in 2008, and from which there will be no recovery, because there's a 96% correlation between GDP growth and greenhouse gas emission.
But why are you so, you may be right in that, why are you so convinced that there is no substitute for oil? You go to great lengths to say the rest, yeah, the alternatives simply aren't credible. Would say they are.
Here, let me pause and with reverence pay homage to the men who taught me. Colin Campbell, who is essentially the godfather of the peak oil movement, Matthew Simmons, the late Matthew Simmons, a dear friend of mine, Richard Heinberg, Jean Laherrere. I could go on with a long list of people who are scientists and who took me through this. First of all, there are 800 million combustion-powered vehicles on the planet, and it took 15,000 to 25,000 gallons of oil to make those vehicles. There's 7 gallons of oil in every tire, paints, plastics, resins, foams, all made from oil. And you have to count the energy involved in the transportation to assemble the vehicle. Those 800 million vehicles will not run on anything except oil. And there is no viable vehicle transportation, either air, land, or sea, except for nuclear-powered submarines, that can replace those vehicles and those engines and the oil needed to run them. And there are also 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy in every calorie of food that we eat in the industrialized world. You take away the oil, and a simple graph of human population shows that human population was stable at about 1 billion people until we hit oil. The population curve went vertical, and there are now 6 billion people on the planet who didn't exist before oil. And if you take the oil away, the population has to shrink.
So we're headed to hell in a hydrocarbon handcart, and there's no other way, you say?
Unless we all become radioactive toast thanks to Fukushima, and Daiichi and Daini and Onagawa and all of the other plants in Japan that are in trouble. Fukushima is now many, many orders of magnitude greater than Chernobyl was. There's 6 reactors there, not one. We've had confirmed meltdowns, and there's 20 years' worth of stored rods there. And that situation is far from under control. And I thought the Christchurch earthquake was bad. And, I have friends down there. We have members of CollapseNet who were down there in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw what happened to Japan. And really, Japan is a mortal wound to the global economy. Japan is a vital organ in a globalized economy.
Yes. Is it a mortal wound to the nuclear industry?
Oh, definitely.
Hmm?
Well, I remember...
Or a temporary one.
I remember being in Paris in 2003, attending a conference of ASPO, the Association for the Study of Peak Oil. And, you know, we're sitting around outside Paris having brandy. It was a wonderful scene with Colin Campbell and Jean Laherrere and Matt Simmons. And Colin made it very clear that one of the utmost priorities of the human race had to be to shut down every nuclear reactor with a cold shutdown as civilization crashed, because if we didn't, they would all go up due to neglect, infrastructure failure, and our own stupidity.
This is a rather depressing assessment of the human ability to adapt, though, isn't it?
That's an excellent question. Boy, you phrased that beautifully. Thank you for the setup. I have a company now, CollapseNet.com, which is short for Collapse Network, and we have links since the movie. We're now in 61 countries, and we've only started last June. And there is an emerging consciousness all over the planet. And again, I'll fall back and quote Colin Campbell, who said to me, I think in about 2002, he said, the species Homo sapiens might not become extinct, but the subspecies of petroleum man most certainly will. And what's happening now, which is why I'm very happy and I look forward to getting up every day, is there's an enormous awakening taking place all over the planet. That people are relocalizing food production. They're taking steps to get off the grid, get out of harm's way, and to live more harmoniously with nature. And I guess to support this, I would cite the recent passage of a national law in Bolivia, matching one in Ecuador, granting Mother Earth the same rights as human beings. So this awakening is underway, and I think that we are seeing two species, an old species which cannot and will not adapt, but a new species I would call post-petroleum man. That really gives me a lot of hope.
Well, yeah, you're sounding like an optimist now.
Well, you have to, you know, there is good with the bad, you know.
Yeah. The argument about other, let's go back to oil, because, I mean, it is crucial to your whole argument. The arguments that there is still a lot of oil out there, that it's going to buy us enough time, Canadian tar sands, all of that, even the Antarctic, and there's enough coal, that'll buy us time. We will be able to adapt as we go through that. Yes, there are climate change implications, which are an awful complication, but that we will adapt and that we must adapt. Does the fact that so much of that as yet untapped oil is still there and people know it's there, and even though it may be expensive, it's still going to be cheaper than wind or tidal in the short run. Does that constrain us? And if that was declared completely off limits, then we would begin to adapt rather more rapidly and more realistically?
Well, I don't think it's a question of having to do the hypothetical of having it declared off limits. Peak oil, by definition, and we know that it happened in 2006, means that you've used up half of the available oil supply, which is presented in a bell curve. But that's the easy half to get.
Yeah.
There will always be oil in the ground, always, because the moment it costs more to get a barrel of oil than it'll sell for, or you burn more than a barrel of oil's worth of energy to get it, there's no point in going after it.
So we will reach a point at which the price of oil at the of petroleum at the pump will simply not be enough, and we can only put the price up to a certain level.
And I believe we're rapidly approaching that point right now.
Yeah. What about clean coal? You are very pessimistic about the possibility of clean coal.
There is no such thing as clean coal. Clean coal does not even begin to address all the pollution that's created before you burn it, the mining, everything else, and it doesn't address the ash, which is highly toxic. And we had a couple of years ago some major leaks, and it just destroyed hundreds of thousands of acres of farmland. And clean coal has never been implemented. It's all a marketing ruse, like the people who are selling us shale gas with fracking, which is murdering people left and right, and all these other marketing gimmicks that are really meant to just keep us believing in something that's failing right in front of our eyes.
Is there a single country in the world in which you would say the realization has now set in and they are beginning to prepare for what you call the non-oil man future?
It'll never happen in terms of a country, because nation states are artificial constructs, essentially. They don't even represent now close tribal or ethnic bonds or anything else. The awakening that's taking place is one that's happening in individuals collectively throughout the consciousness. And I think it would be a total mistake to try to make any nation state do it, because they're incapable. They're like dinosaurs. They just can't think outside of their old paradigm. They have no other response mechanisms, and that's why governments are so transparently failing all over the world.
I'm talking to Michael Rupert, the author of Collapse and Crossing the Rubicon, which came out in 2004, I think. I watched the movie Collapse, and I couldn't help feeling that I was being emotionally manipulated watching it. There you were in this sitting on this chair in a rather forbidding cellar-like setting.
I was being emotionally manipulated too.
Were you?
Yeah.
And you had moments where you were burst into tears at all of this. And people said, and a couple of reviewers have said, this is just emotionally manipulating us. I guess you were aware of the fact that you would be accused of that.
No, actually, this is the first time I ever have been accused of that.
Huh. No,
because what they got was the real me. The movie was shot on 5 separate shoots between March and June of 2009.
Why that setting, though? Almost a bunker-like.
Oh, I had no say in that. That was all decided by Chris Smith, the director. He's a brilliant filmmaker. He'd won Sundance twice. This was a full-scale theatrical thing. I was just the subject of the film. I didn't have anything to do with its design.
Uh-huh. You broke down a couple of times. I mean, and a number of reviewers of Collapse, the book, have said this is somebody who is right on the edge all the time. And it seems that you have been, for the last few years, right on the edge.
I think there's a lot of people who would say I've been on the edge for 30 years or more. That's fine with me.
Yeah.
I have this wonderful collection of friends. Oh, and I let me correct something if I might. The companion book is called Confronting Collapse. There is no book called Collapse.
Confronting
Collapse.
That's a
Diamond book.
Yeah, yeah.
Mine is Confronting Collapse. But, you know, this living on the edge has earned me this amazing gallery of friends and colleagues. I have pictures in my office of Dick Marcinko, who founded SEAL Team 6, my good friend and editor, brilliant writer Stan Goff from Special Forces, Tracker Tom Brown, Mel Gibson, Leo DiCaprio. And if that's the kind of people I attract, I'm okay with that.
What was it that actually brought you to tears in that movie? Was it the future of mankind? I mean, is it that stark?
No, well, that is something everybody will have to digest. But what that was specifically was, there were so many of us, and here I go back to the ones who were at it before I was, who labored so long on the field of peak oil at the very beginning part of the learning curve, and so many of us broke down, gave up, just succumbed to the weight of rejection and denial, and we saw so clearly what was coming, and we've all been vindicated now. But that was the intense frustration of trying to tell people something that is actually so obvious and simple. And I was weeping not just for my own frustration, but for all of the people who had worked so hard, and how I had seen us all just want to give up and quit, and some did.
I had Matt Simmons on this program, several years ago, when Twilight in the Desert came out and it was the definitive book on how much oil is left in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, etc. And he said he was completely despairing at what was happening, and nobody was listening. What is it about your personality, if I can put it that way, that brought you back into this? You gave up. You said, I mean, I'm out of here. You went to Venezuela, I think, after From the Wilderness, I think, was a band. This was your website and your newsletter. You said, that's it, I've had enough. What brought you back?
Well, what happened that sent me to Venezuela is important to understand. We did a tremendous amount of investigative journalism, serious investigative journalism at From the Wilderness. Many times Congress relied on our work, and I had 60 members of Congress as subscribers. But In 2006, Mary Tillman, the mother of our football player, Pat Tillman, who quit his pro football career and joined Army Rangers, came to me, and I had Stan Goff, a retired Special Forces Master Sergeant. We obtained the documents, and we published a seven-part series with Stan Goff doing some brilliant writing, which broke the Pat Tillman cover-up. We got nine officers were disciplined, three of them generals, and I believe we made Donald Rumsfeld quit. But in the course of that, a very, very nasty, dirty tricks campaign was thrown at me. My computers were smashed. My life was threatened. I was set up on sexual harassment charges. And I believe my life was in danger. And I fled in the middle of that series to Venezuela to make sure that it could be published, because the only thing that could have prevented it would have been my death at that point. I was the publisher editor. And I was poisoned in Venezuela. So basically, I was beaten. I was down. I was broken. I had nothing left. And I started to reassemble, if you will, and to heal. But in 2008, my dear friend Cynthia McKinney and I were talking, and you know, she jokingly said that I should be her vice presidential running mate on the Green Party ticket. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that I became aware of was, oh my God, we needed a real presidential energy policy, which became the book, Confronting Collapse. Just shortly after I started writing it, maybe two or three months, Chris Smith approached me and asked about the film. So I was kind of called back into the fray.
So you've now established this organization called the Collapse Network.
CollapseNet, yes.
CollapseNet. What's the objective? I mean, is this to build a constituency, to get people to see reality, to get others to help you to persuade people that we're in trouble?
Its primary purpose is to facilitate and expedite networking among the millions of people around the world. And I know because the movie Collapse was pirated 2 million times, I've had no income from it.
That's a very good indicator of the way the world economy works.
Yeah, but I also have 8,000 Facebook friends all over the world. So, you know, there are trade-offs. And so CollapseNet exists to kind of identify and bring together all the work that people all over the world who have seen this coming for many, many, many years have been doing to prepare for it, to share the information. And we have an amazing lighthouse directory with 1,300 hand-picked entries. That's absolutely free on our site. We have a number of free services where everything is indexed so that people who have a lot of questions can go right to the directory and start looking. So we want to facilitate the networking, and then I do news analysis every day on my World News Desk. That's for our subscribers. And basically what I'm known as is the weatherman. I've been amazingly accurate in predicting near, mid, and long-term events since we've started that, and I analyze news stories from around the world every day, between 100 to 150 stories a day that are researched and culled for me, and then we assemble them and I put them together with comments, and we're pretty much able to tell everybody what's coming next.
What's coming next? Tell us. What's coming on the immediate horizon?
What's coming next is like picture God walking up to the whirring blender and hitting the puree switch. There's a whole lot of variables in play now. Fukushima is an ongoing, uncontrolled nuclear event. The dollar looks to be crashing very rapidly. Last week, about a week ago, the chairman of the People's Bank of China announced, and it was put out by Xinhua, which is the official Chinese news agency, that China intends to sell $2 trillion.
Yeah.
That's the dollar dump. And that will trigger instant hyperinflation. It's amazing how this is playing out, but it's very clear that Wall Street Journal, Financial, everybody sees that the dollar is now weaker than it has been at any point since 2008. But we have an ongoing European collapse. The EU is collapsing under financial debt. We have all the revolts and revolutions, not only through the Middle East and North Africa, that are spreading. And I would submit,
I was going to ask you about those. Is this some kind of massive peasants' revolt, which will spread?
I have been calling it a generational revolt because it's not certainly geographically confined. You had 40,000 people in the streets in Delhi, India, over food prices. There's a major food crisis going on. I mean, in a biblical food crisis that is emerging. UN figures have reported, or the World Bank, 1.1 billion people are at risk of starving to death this year.
Hmm.
But this I view as a generational revolution, and it's also, I guess, partially manifested by the relatively mild unrest we've had in the states over states like Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, all pulling the rug from under collective bargaining. That's accelerating. So I see widespread civil unrest happening this year. And it is happening. If you look at the Middle East, North Africa, Syria, Bahrain, Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, all throughout that region, I'm being interviewed by the Arab Times tomorrow. But that's spreading everywhere. And of course, we've seen last summer's massive protests in France, and all that's only going to get worse from here on out. But clearly for me, the number one story in the world right now remains Fukushima. And that is threatening to all life on the planet. Dr. Helen Caldicott, just a brilliant woman who knows her stuff, has really summed it up, that Fukushima, if it's not controlled, has the ability to kill everything on the planet.
So there you go. That was Michael C. Rupert, and as you heard in the interview, his website is collapsenet.com.